Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
Disclaimer. This talk contains descriptions of violence and sexual assault which may be triggering to some individuals. Listener discretion is advised. Good evening, everyone. Tonight, our speaker will be Travis Marceau, and he will be speaking on letting go of dreams. I think most of you know Travis. He's been with Canando for a number of years. So with that, I'm going to unmute you, Travis, and welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody. Good evening. Good to see the familiar faces. It's a pleasure to speak tonight, and thank you. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak to you, each of you. As I hear that loving kindness meditation, the line that sticks out for me is the, not wishing, riches even for one's family. And, particularly with my daughters at the age that they are, it's something I think about. And, my younger daughter, Alice, is 12, and she's grown tall in the last year. And, just to wish her health is something that occupies a lot of my mind. And, she enjoys skateboarding, and she's actually at a sleepover right now with a neighbor, and two neighbors actually, and that may be, I haven't looked at the recent guidelines on that, but I think it's healthy, and I'm happy she can do that. And I think health is a rarer quantity than we would all like. What I'm most happy about is that she's free to be a kid, and she has that ease that comes with that. And we don't talk about what she wants to be when she grows up, or what, hero she looks up to. So I think that's a good thing. But, I talked about Huckleberry Finn a few months ago. And when I ended with that, I said, I think it remained an essentially unfinished novel. And since then, I've kind of thought about why that is. And why was it so difficult to finish? Just to play that back, after he has that great personal trial, he goes and saves Jim. But I think it's difficult because we can't actually save anyone from the sufferings of life. And maybe our highest purpose or aspiration is to really only help the people that we're with to the extent that we're capable. Recently I was having an intense discussion, and someone politely suggested that I think about this quote that has been attributed to various sages like the Buddha, Socrates, and even Rumi. And you, I'm sure some of you have heard it, but it goes like this. Is it true? Is it necessary? Is it kind? Well, I'm going to relate a personal anecdote tonight, and I hope that you find that this story passes those three criteria for you. I was exactly Alice's age when I went out for the middle school football team in the fall of my seventh grade year. I joined a few days late after being urged to join by a friend. You know, it seemed exciting and I enjoyed sports, but of course, tackle football was daunting. And I was tall and skinny like Alice. So I'm at practice. And this would be 1988, the year after my grandfather died. We were running drills, like the kind where you jump on the ground, or you're on the ground and then you jump off the ground and then hit something or hit somebody. And I'm in this group of like four guys. So I do my drill, which only takes a few seconds. And I turn around and Danico is pushing Paxton. Danico, Paxton, and I all went to George Washington Elementary School together, fourth and fifth grade. And the things I remember with those guys so long ago now were the beginning of the day in class, turning in lunch money. The crossing patrol was a big deal for me. The crossing guard, when you get to be one of the older elementary school kids, you help the younger kids across the street, and playing kickball. And kickball, if you're not familiar, it's a game that's sort of like American baseball, you know, but it's with those red rubber dodgeballs that American school gyms have. So we'd play kickball in the morning before school. We'd play at lunch recess, and I loved it. And we had this blacktop, you know, that was where we usually played, that was next to our classroom. And our classroom was in left field. In fact, if you could kick well enough, you could kick the ball onto the roof of the school. And that was really sensational. And of course, like it was a home run, right? Sort of like if you follow baseball, it'd be like hitting a ball over the old green monster at Fenway Park in Boston. And there were two kids that could do that, and their names were Gary and Herbie. And so they would always get kicked first. They would always get picked first. And after that, so, you know, it was a, you know, typical, you know, boys, pecking order. And, after that would be Danico, Jeremy, me, Brandon, Jimmy, and Paxton. And, you know, there were a few variations there. So there's a little bit of, you know, interest every day to see what teams we would be on. But we had just enough players to have the pitcher and then the outfield. And that was our little world back then. And, you know, and I dreamed about kicking the ball up there. So then fast forward 3 years and we're in middle school and this is practice and it's hot. And I turn to go around to go to the back of the line and this is what I see. So I just run up and do that sort of separation thing between the two of them. And they say, you know, stop pushing it. And then Danico starts pushing me. And his eyes are strange, like really angry. And I don't understand what's going on. And this just lasts a few seconds because Coach Ron sees us and just kind of casually says, you know, take a lap. So Danico and I both run off in the opposite directions. And then I meet him at the halfway point and he doesn't look at me. And then I get back and everybody's smiling. Because it appears that it's been decided that we're going to fight after practice. So I'm going to pause and just reveal something that I didn't really know then that I know now. And I only know because of upon quite a bit of reflection of what happened. Paxton was the smallest kid on the team, and that's why he got picked last at kickball. And he had only one means, in my view, to provoke Danico, who you might be able to suspect by his name was Black. So you might have an understanding of likely what happened. When I shared this story with my parents earlier this year, my mother said, well, he was a mulatto. But I don't think Paxton was so nuanced. So it was a long march back. We had about a half mile to get back to middle school from high school. And that high school has since been burned down by a young arsonist. So it's no longer there to build character of the young Keokuk youth. But I remember being the last kid in that locker room that day. And the sun coming through the windows and the stink of it, which that sort of pubescent, you know, boy funk that's unique. And I had to walk down the hallway to my locker. And it was quiet when I was walking. And I thought, well, maybe they all just left and they're going home. But as I took the left turn, I see the majority of the team standing there. Paxton isn't there. The boy who convinced me to go out for the team, you know, just a few weeks ago, wasn't there. And that was the closest, that is the closest person I have to in my life. He's not there. And everybody's camped around my locker. So Danica's leaning on the wall just in front of my locker. And as I walk by, his friend Brandon, who also happens to be Black, steps behind me. Just as he steps out, he pushes me in the back so that I bump into Danico. And Danico punches me in the face. I don't think Danico wanted to hurt me. Maybe he did. I don't think he did. But he, you know, I said something like something kind of, you know, goofy, like, well, you call that a punch or something like that. And then there's a split second. And I looked at him and I said, I'm not going to fight you, Danico. And I was as calm as I could be. And I remember I said his name and that I looked right at him. And I remember that he looked right at me. And his eyes were clear then. And that moment was, it seemed like an eternity. And then he just looked down and walked past me. And then everyone completely silently funneled out of the hallway. And as I got my books, I could remember the flood of relief. More than any relief I think I've ever felt, you know. And just like that, I'm out on the street. Parents are waiting. Kids are getting into cars. It's like, it's like a complete scene change. But then there's a second feeling that comes, and it's also strong, and it's loneliness. And it's feeling like you got nobody, you're abandoned. And nobody was there for me. So thinking about it now, I think Danica was frustrated. And I was thrust into a situation, right? And he was frustrated about a world that he had been learning about since those days at George Washington. And, you know, at least from my perspective, I think he was trying to teach the bigger world, which our team was at the time, our football team was at the time, how he should be treated. And, you know, who's a better target than me? I felt safer around him after that day. He would sometimes just come up and stand near me after that. And why we didn't talk, I don't know. But if you want to know the truth of it, that's the racism I'm interested in. And neither of us need, you know, we didn't seem to know what to say. But now, as an older as a person who can kind of look back at myself compassionately, I can think about, like, yeah, it's just enough. It's just enough to be okay with each other. I mean, what would I have said? Remember kickball? What did Paxton do to piss you off that day? I'm gonna read a quote right now. It comes as a great shock around the age of 5 or 6 or 7 to discover that the flag to which you have pledged allegiance along with everybody else has not a pledged allegiance to you. It comes as a great shock to discover that Gary Cooper killing off the Indians when you were rooting for Gary Cooper, that the Indians were you. It comes as a great shock to discover that the country which is your birthplace and to which you owe your life and your identity has not, in its whole system of reality, evolved any place for you. The disaffection, demoralization, and gap between one person and another only on the basis of the color of their skin begins there and accelerates through a whole lifetime. To the present, when you realize you're 30, and are having a terrible time managing to trust your countrymen. By the time you are 30, you have been through a certain kind of mill. And the most serious effect of the mill you've been through is, again, not the catalog of disaster, the policemen, the taxi drivers, the waiters, the landlady, the landlord, the banks, the insurance companies, the millions of details, 24 hours a day, which spell out to you that you are a worthless human being. It's not that. It's by that time you've begun to see that happening to your daughter or your son or your niece or your nephew. That's James Baldwin from a well-known Cambridge debate of William F. Buckley in 1965. There were no black police in my hometown, no black teachers. If you had gone up the river to Burlington, which was a larger town with more black folks, you would find that. But what I'm describing is far more intimate and insidious. Reverend Jennifer Bailey is a preacher from the Bethel African Methodist Episcopal Church from my mother's hometown just down the river, where my parents live now. She's been on TED and On Being, which is a popular spiritual podcast. And her hook, if you can pardon me calling it that, is describing to the audience when she was 5 and was going down a slide and another boy sliding behind her and saying to her, "You must be dirty, because why else would your skin be brown?" I rode that slide, and I recognized that voice walking up behind me and whispering in my ear. It's authentic of that place, and as specifically heard by a little kid. Opportunities like this that we have right now to discuss morality openly are not easy to create. And history can't contend with it. Racism, like all oppressive systems at their root, destroy one's sense of reality. And we need to go under and dig that out by its roots. You know, just like at a Canandoah Garden Day. That's the ground we need to work. Danico went to university. He studied sociology and criminal justice. And so he probably eventually learned who James Baldwin was. And I can only confirm that he sat through 12 hours of Shelby Foote's rich descriptions of the terror tactics along the Mississippi during the Civil War, because we watched the PBS Civil War documentary together in class. And we learned much more about the Pericles of Athens, the Pericles of Buddha's day. We learned much more about him than we learned about the Black Hawk of our own soil. Danico dropped out before graduating. He raped a woman. I don't know the circumstances exactly, just what I read in the town paper, which reported that he punched her in the face, crushed one of her vertebrae, and lacerated a kidney. And he wouldn't have likely been caught, except he assaulted another woman a few months later. It was snowing then, and the campus police tracked him back to his apartment there in the married housing complex of the university. I lived in that housing. and he's been in jail about half of his life now. My sisters have been sexually abused, assaulted, and raped. My daughters, nieces, and nephews seem to have it better than we did. As a patriarch, I worry about other forms of abuse that are hard to shake. Yet I know and must contend with the patriarchal excesses of the kind Ken Burns sentimentalizes. Where I'm from, if you're smart, you leave as best you can, even though you can't really shake it. I remember the good ones, like Gary and Herbie. They're dead. They died real young. And maybe there's still a ball or two up on the roof. At least in my mind, I hope so. There's a book that Baldwin wrote called If Beale Street Could Talk. And it's about a couple in love where the man is wrongfully accused of rape. And it's been recently made into a movie. And I think it has pretty good reviews. You know, Athenians would make dialectic proposals, but that's not me. That's a culture to grow out of. I would suggest that we distinguish between experiences and entertainment and learn to value the former, because building the kind of cultural literacy required of our citizenry is the vital groundwork of our future together. Some people would say we need to take time and make an effort to listen. Yeah, to start. But too much listening is also a silence, and it creates another. What I think would be great is if America, all of America, could talk about how worthless and meaningless how we feel, what our jobs, what we do feels sometimes. Is that true? Is that necessary? Is that kind? Leo Tolstoy formed three questions of his own the same year that Huck Finn was published. And I think I have time to share it with you. It's written as a parable that sounds like a Buddhist story. Here goes. There's a king, and it occurs to him that if he could just answer three questions, he would be able to rule the kingdom very well. And this comes to him as a dream. And the three questions are: what's the right time to begin something? Who are the right people to listen to, and who should we avoid? And the third question is, what is the most important thing to do? And he, you know, in his court, he has counselors and priests and advisors, and, you know, the counselors help him set up a structured day to have a right time for everything. And, you know, that sort of regimented schedule where it's all taken care of. And, you know, there's a bunch of different counsel that that come, and they say, okay, well, you have to listen to the priests, and you have to listen to the warriors, and you have to listen to the counselors, and then as far as, you know, what's the most important thing to do, this is 1885, so they're like, science is the most important thing, or religious worship is the most important thing. And so he, unsatisfied by all this, he leaves the kingdom, and he hears that there's a hermit that's out in the woods, and he dresses as a common man, and he goes out there to see him. And he finds this hermit, and the guy's digging on his field, and he's old and emaciated, and he doesn't have he's having a really hard time of it. So you know, he asks him these questions, and he doesn't respond, but he takes pity on the old man, and then he starts digging. And then after a few hours, the old man thanks him and starts digging himself once he's, you know, had a go at it. But just then another man runs up, and he has a abdominal wound, and he's bleeding, and he's really in trouble. So the king takes this guy, dresses his wounds, feeds him, puts him in bed, and then he falls asleep exhausted. And so the next morning, he wakes up, and, you know, he talks to the injured man, and the injured man apologizes to him. And he said, you know, you executed my brother, and I was coming to kill you. But your guards found me and they injured me. And I forgive you. And I thank you for saving my life. And I wish to be your slave. And the king says, oh my gosh, you know, no, you're forgiven. And, you know, I'm sorry that we had this misunderstanding. And then they make up, and the guy recovers. And before the king leaves, he goes and sees the hermit. And he said, you know, you still didn't answer my three questions. And, you know, the hermit says, but you already know now. The right time to do something is now. And the right people to listen to is the person that is right in front of you. And the most important thing to do is help them. And, you know, I think, you know, it's another set of questions, but in truth, I think the Buddha would suggest you ask your own questions. Maybe these are a start. Hermits are rarer and rarer these days, but my hope for people is to be as curious and as clear-headed as possible when we think about other human beings. We're all human beings. And there's no true other. And I believe that this understanding is necessary for us, for all of us. And that big mind that knows this innately is with us now, ready to help and support each other. A tyrant or a single bad decision can destroy a life. But no wise person can do more than guide you to learn for yourself what good you can do for all life. Thank you.
We're now open for any questions. I actually have a question for you, Travis. So you talked a lot about your childhood, and it sounds like you grew up in a really rough area where you went through a lot and the people around you went through a lot of violence and things. And I want to know what you learned from that experience.
I learned how to have a relationship with dreams. Sometimes we have to temper them. Sometimes we have to assert them. But they're tied to our motivation. And when you're in a circumstance where human misery is so intense, they are they can be the map out. Thank you.
Thank you. Peter.
Thank you, Charlotte. I don't have a comment or a question. I just want
Can you speak up a little bit, Peter? I can't hear you very well. That's why.
Does that work better?
Much better. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Travis. I didn't have a comment or a question, but just hearing your talk tonight felt like a real gift, and I'm really grateful for it. Thank you.
Thanks, Peter.
Teresa.
Hi, Travis.
Hi, Teresa.
Thank you for your talk. So I wanted to ask you, what are your dreams now?
I know that I can't really be a hermit, but a lot of my dreams consist of having enough space and time to heal. As you know, the work that we do a lot in the Silicon Valley is intense and corrosive in some ways to the psyche. And it's not really human sized. So one of the things that drew me to Kanendo and Zen practice was the human sized aspects of the practice, the way that we sweep the Ngawa and the way that we establish rituals in both the Zendo and around the Zendo. And so that's given actually some breathing space for me to consider what my, what the second half of my life could be. And, I think the other thing that emerges when you've had the success that I've had, and I've been successful. I've achieved a lot of dreams, and when you achieve a dream, that you don't think about that anymore. Like you've done it, right? So I know that our minds tend to fixate on the things that we don't have or we haven't achieved, but in the process of having things, I've started to get more curious about expectations. And I've started to exhaust the things that are more self-centered. So I think my highest aspiration or dream is to help others now and to find a good way to do that. Thanks. Mm-hmm.
Columbine.
I had just a follow-up question for that. How would you like to help others?
Good question. I'd love it to be like a you know, Fred Astaire dance routine, but it's not that easy. And, you know, I actually like enjoy history. I enjoy the sentimental aspects of listening to old baseball games on YouTube. I think that one of the things that's happening now is we're talking about how, you know, traditional practice can meld with a, you know, modern world. And, you know, most of my effort is really to make sure that my daughters are healthy. I know that I have a very like short runway for that. They're already teenagers, and I have limited time with them. So I think a lot about how to help them. But I also think about the vows I've taken as a Zen student, and what could be, you know, the last couple decades of my life post retirement from working life. But I have a team at work. I have 8 folks that are on my staff, and there's emotional aspects as well as technical, and there's conflict and anxiety, and especially now with the shutdown, you know, it's hard to navigate. And it seems like that's not going to change anytime soon. So I have plenty to work on. My parents are coming in a few weeks, which is, you know, always an opportunity for me to be on my A game and really be there for them. So, and then beyond that, it's, you know, you're only going to grow your ability to help in an organic way with the people that you're closest to, and then out from there. Thanks.
Dan?
Travis, that talk was brutal. You know, it was hard for me to listen to.
And I know.
Sorry?
I know, Dan.
Yeah. And it's also hard, you know, I find it hard to look into that much pain and suffering for long, you know, and I just want to state that. And I guess I wonder where you find the energy or the ability to stare at that, because you've thought about it, and that's hard to think about. It's hard to feel it. So I guess the question is, where, how do you do that? I mean, I don't know if I have a question, but it's I just want to recognize that it's that was hard, you know, it's hard.
Yeah,
I mean, don't want to look at that, you know. I don't think.
No, not a lot of people want to, and it's lonely to share that with loved ones and not really feel that they want to look at it either. Yeah, thanks for acknowledging that, because, you know, and thank you all for being here to hear that. And I know it's and I have other stories. That's just one of them, you know. So it's something I wanted to tell you about, because I know that with the with the current situation with the country and discussions about race, I felt compelled to talk about it because it doesn't have an easy answer, and it doesn't single out a certain person and say, you know, or a certain group and say, oh, you know, well, that's the bad one. And how can you really demonize a child? Mm. You know, which we were all children once. And you know, it's like at some point you have to accept and try to reach across and help. And I think that the way that we do that is going to be difficult and awkward, and you know, it's going to be a struggle. But I think it's the kind of work that, if I'm honest with myself, that's the work where I would feel at the end like, yeah, that's the work I'm capable of doing to help others. And I just want to say it additionally, I really appreciate being able to say their names, you know, saying the names of those kids. And my mom, like, she saved my, like, class, you know, picture, you know, with all the kids. And, you know, I just want to, like, read some of these names because, you know, I miss them. And you know, they're still in my mind. Hyla, Carrie, Terrace, Nasony, Danielle, Cecily, Shannon, Joanna, that's a few of them. I don't think it's sentimental to do that, you know, to remember that. If it's from the experience, it's not over. From the real experience, I don't think it's overly sentimental. One of the things that I remember about Danico was that we were the only two guys that brought up our reduced lunch every day. It was 45 cents for school lunch. And, you know, everyone else, there was like, okay, so like Herbie and Gary, they had free lunch. So they didn't have to bring up any money. And full price lunch was something like $1.20 or something. But I had to bring up a lousy like 45 cents a day. And that was the worst. I would have wanted to be one or the other. But reduced lunch, that was the worst.
Travis, I have this thought, but I don't have a clear question in mind, but it's something that's stuck in my head from your story, which is Danico and yourself and that altercation, I guess, in a locker room or wherever it was, that I don't think he wanted to fight you and I don't think you wanted to fight him. It was another boy that pushed you into him to try to start a fight, like an instigation. And that just sticks in my mind, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Brandon, like that was the setup. They had it all like worked out. So I was going to walk by and then I was going to get the shove, but you know, the hardest thing was to just walk down that hall. That was the hardest thing. And you know, I don't think he wanted to fight me. But he wanted to send a message, right? And the most important thing was, you know, he felt helpless too, and that this just can't continue. He had to make a statement to the rest of the team. And you know, to see that whole team just kind of like attentive, like I remember their eyes, they were just, oh, there's going to be a fight. This is going to be great. And that sort of like mob, little, you know, 12-year-old, like, you know, mob mentality. But like, yeah, I mean, I think when I said that to him, you know, and I said his name and you know, I acknowledged him. I think that that changed it. But he might have just like realized that he was in a situation where he was surrounded by, you know, 50 other kids that wasn't safe. I can't ever know, you know.
Yeah, I think what it's making me think is that how many divisions like this are simulated, you know, Republican versus Democrat, Black versus white, where yeah. It's actually not the people, but someone externally just trying to trigger and make people feel divided or attacked. Yeah. And then, yeah. Then people react. And maybe the way you reacted of just like, hey, I'm not going to fight you. Like maybe that's the way out of this on a national or global scale. I don't know. Just a thought.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't tell that story tonight to portray myself as some kind of hero. I was trying to survive. And, you know, I was trying, you know, doing whatever I could to avoid being in a fight. And specifically, like, you know, if you've seen fights, like, that, you know, like, you can get punched, that's fine. But when you're on the ground, that's when bad things happen. And it was like a linoleum floor and, you know, all these kids around, and it's just not good. And kids who got in fights in my school, that like, you know, the kids that were challenged, you know, with school, like they didn't help themselves. Let me say that. There was one kid named Bubba, and Bubba would challenge me to a fight at every school dance. And I don't mind admitting that I fancy myself as quite a dancer. So I would sit on the bleachers, you know, between songs, and Bubba and his crew would come up and they would just come at me, needle me every dance. And I never fought Bubba, but I only learned again recently from talking with my mom, that my mom had humiliated him in sixth grade in front of the math team. The sixth grade math team. Yeah, she's a teacher. So she's the math teacher. And then it kind of clicked for me. Oh, that's why Bubba was always had a chip on his shoulder with me.
Columbine?
I know I already asked a question, but your story about the reduced lunches reminds me, like you said, yeah, maybe it'd be better to just have it free or not. But when I was a kid, we used to get food stamps. And I remember just thinking that was the coolest thing. Like, we would go to a Berkeley Bowl. And I remember my perception of food stamps was like you would get a packet and you could spend it on certain things. Like, and I remember I really wanted as a child, you know, the sparkling apple cider. So I think a lot of it has to do with like perception, you know, and maybe for you, it was a lot, there was a lot of guilt or shame associated with it, but it's interesting, you know, how it gets delivered to us as a child. You know, when I was a child, I thought it was, you know, my mom probably explained it to me that, you know, this is what we get for this. So I thought it was great. It's interesting the difference in how we observe those things.
Yeah, thanks. Thank you for sharing that, Columbine. Yeah, you know, my town had a different demographic in my grandfather's day, and my grandfather started a successful dairy in the 50s or 40s, which continued until the mid 80s. And then this was right after the dairy had had closed, and then he got cancer shortly after that, and he died in 87. But he was a guy that would be at that dairy, you know, selling milk and ice cream, and everybody from town would come in and talk to him. And so the first, until I was like 10 or 11, like, you know, one of the things I really enjoyed was being in that dairy and, you know, having him, you know, just talk to all the folks in town. And then when the dairy closed, my parents had to figure out what to do. And my mom, as I said, was a teacher. My dad decided to go back to school to be a teacher. So that hard period of time from fourth grade to, you know, I don't know, seventh, eighth grade, that was temporary. And I'm very proud of, you know, how my parents like were able to, you know, evolve and grow and you know that was instrumental for me too. So but it meant that my dad was away, and I lost my grandfather, and my dad was away at school a lot during those times. And you know, maybe that time built something for me that I have still. So yeah, I don't look back on it with regret, but I think the important thing is for folks to be honest and just share their experience, and that's what I'm trying to do.
Any other questions? All right. Well, with that, I think we can close. So, thank you for this very candid and you're very open with some very difficult truths. So thank you, Travis.
Thank you.
This talk was brought to you by the Canando Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.